Hello and welcome to the Just Fly Performance Podcast, episode 14. Today on the show, we have Boo Schexnader, track coach, educator, and sports performance specialist. Today's episode is brought to you by Simply Faster. Simply Faster is an online athletic performance technology shop distributing items such as the Freelap Timing System, GymAware, K-Box, 1080 Sprint, and the Speedmat. I've gotten many of these items from Simply Faster and can confidently say that they make today's best training technology available to everybody. The Freelap Timing System has revolutionized both my practices and my athlete assessments, allowing me to look at the 10-meter fly capability of dozens of athletes in a matter of seconds. It is wireless, compact, portable, and incredibly versatile. The K-Box and 1080 Sprint are fantastic tools for any coach looking to build speed, agility, and implement training scenarios that go beyond the traditional weight room. The 1080 Sprint is being used by great coaches, training some of the fastest sprinters in the world, and it truly represents high-performance speed training. I can personally attest that Simply Faster's customer service is second to none. Christopher at Simply Faster responds quickly to queries, and anyone who makes a purchase from Simply Faster is in good hands. If you want to acquire some of the best high-tech training equipment available, stop by simplyfaster.com. That's simply with an I, faster.com. They are the future of coaching technology. All right, welcome to the show. Glad to have you guys on today. I'm really excited for this episode as I have Boo Schexnader, legendary track and field coach who formerly coached 19 NCAA champions at LSU. Boo is a pioneer of the sport of track and field and has developed the most commonly used jumps training template in the collegiate ranks, and for good reason. He has worked at every level of the sport, having coached at the high school, collegiate, and Olympic levels. Boo is not only a great track coach, but also an active educator in the curriculum development for coaching education, such as the USTF CCCA Track and Field Academy. He currently serves as the director for sports performance training for the Thibodaux Regional Medical Center. Boo Schexnader was one of the earliest names I can remember from back when I was first getting into how to approach jumps training, so I can definitely say this has been one of my favorite episodes to put together so far in the podcast. One of the things I really enjoy about Boo is his common sense, no-nonsense attitude towards training. And with all the options and variety out there in today's training environment, all the bells and whistles, Boo is a guy who can take the greatest complexities of training and put it into a simple package that we can all understand and utilize and get great results with. Today, we're going to talk on many aspects of jump, speed, and strength training. So this podcast isn't just for track coaches, but also strength and conditioning and sports performance enthusiasts alike. I hope you enjoy listening to it as much as I did putting it together. Okay, welcome to the show today, Boo. It's great having you on.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Awesome. So I'm really excited to chat with you a little bit about various aspects of both jump training setups and then some general questions of athletic development. The first thing I'd really like to talk with you about is regarding your programming, particularly for the jumps in track and field. And I've found that that is definitely one of the most commonly used templates in the world, very effective. How did you arrive at the current system that you use to train jumps, and who are some of the biggest influences in how you arrived there?
Well, I was very fortunate when I got started in high school coaching. Not many people know that. When I first got started in high school coaching, this is in the very early 80s, I was still pretty young as a coach, and Dan Paff was right up the road, and I developed a relationship with Dan, and he was a great mentor for me in my young days. And when I was kind of questioning myself real early because I thought I saw things differently than most people did, he was a great person to pat me on the back and tell me that, yeah, you're seeing it clearly, just keep doing what you're doing, you know. And then I was also lucky to be on the ground floor in coaching education, and one of the people who was very influential in that early curriculum development was Roger Inoka, the neurophysiologist, and he kind of was a big influence on me and the way I thought as well. And so I just kind of was fortunate enough to be around some good people at a young age, and who gave me the confidence to kind of look at things in my own telescope and see them the way I saw them. I understood specificity as a young coach, and I just spent time really looking hard at what the different events required and what the demands were for those events, and then I worked backwards, meaning that Rather than copying systems, I kind of devised systems that I thought addressed what the events demanded. And when I saw other coaches like Dan who were doing similar things, then my system kind of evolved from that, I guess you would say. And then being able to, I always feel that good coaches precede the science. You know, some coaches kind of wait for the science to come out and then you apply the science. I never really felt that way. I think the good coaches are pioneers, and I always tried to be a pioneer. And if it made sense to me, I tried to do it, even though the science didn't necessarily support it, or I should say, if research didn't support it at the time. And then I kind of looked for confirmation as to why it worked well from science after. So I think that's another thing that I was fortunate enough was to kind of have a pioneer mindset and not really be afraid to go out on a limb as far as trying things. And if I thought that my understanding of training and my understanding of the events themselves was valid.
Awesome. I definitely think that the idea of coaches as pioneers, and then the research will kind of catch up with those coaches who are making those on the front decisions.
Yeah, if you're waiting for the research, you could be helping a lot of kids in the meantime while you're waiting for the research to come out.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. It's awesome that you were able to have such a great influence with Dan Path, and it's certainly awesome to see that work show up in that jump template of yours that's so popular and effective right now. One of the things I'm really excited to pick your brain about is your thoughts on the 3 day or the 3 day training setup with three high intensity neuromuscular days. So Monday, Wednesday, and Friday doing the high intensity sprints, plyos, weights type options. And then the three easier days, Tuesday, Thursday, Friday, being more metabolic or easier in nature days versus some 4 day training options where coaches might prescribe plyometrics on, say, Monday, Thursday, and weights on Tuesday, Friday, where there's four high intensity nervous system element days. And how, what's kind of the biggest differences there, and how would coaches maybe go about deciding which one might be a viable option in training, or which athletes that type of thing might work well for or not?
Well, my system is kind of noted for three neuromuscular days, but I should say that kind of evolved to a large extent out of the need to follow academic calendars and academic schedules and things of that nature. So a lot of it is practical, you know, based around the fact that there are 7 days in a week and we're on typical weekly schedules. I have had trained athletes fairly successfully in systems where I did like 2 to 3 neuromuscular days back to back, and then followed up with long restoration periods, and then come back with those 3 back to back days again. So I'm not really philosophically opposed to either. The 3 day training setup gives you a nice way to practically address all of those elements, and also gives you a way to address them in ways that enable you to achieve the intensities that you need. The 4 day options, where you might, for example, have back-to-back neuromuscular days, maybe like a speed day on a Monday followed by a big strength day on a Tuesday, those give you the advantage of being able to go in deeper and address motor units the motor units that hit the first day. The body has to be more resourceful in recruitment on the second day. So those are really good training constructs as well. The only thing is that I firmly believe that over the course of time, the ratio between the neuromuscular days and the other more restorative base types of days kind of has to stay, hover in a particular zone. So I think there are numerous advantages to both, to be very frank with you. It's just that the 3 day system is typically much more practical, I guess you would say. 4 day options where you can go back to back days, like I mentioned, they're great ways to duplicate the effects of a 2 day competition, or a good way to mimic a trial final kind of situation, or even if you're just trying to get in deeper than you ordinarily would. You know, after all, throws coaches typically make their living doing those types of arrangements. Normally, the volumes of neuromuscular work that we do in the jumps world don't necessarily mandate the fact that we do those kind of days back to back, but in throws types of scenarios, or when you're dealing with big people in other sports, quite frankly, those 4 day options are really good ones. So I'm not really married to one or the other. The one thing that is a little different is when you look at the different levels of athletes, you know, the better the athlete, typically the more rest they need in between neuromuscular training bouts, whether they're neuromuscular single day bouts or neuromuscular multiple day bouts. So that is something, again, that kind of lends itself back to what I said about the ratio between neural training and restorative training. As long as you're looking at long-term balance there, I think you're fine, and there are lots of ways to skin that cat.
Yeah, that's a great point. And that actually leads right into the next question I was going to go ahead and ask you between with the differences between training kind of your intermediate level and then your advanced or elite athlete. And so how do you go about deciding how to adjust training based on those athletic populations?
Well, to me, there are two types of athletes, those that are and they aren't really based on talent. They're based more on where an athlete is with respect to their genetic potential. You know, you have those that are still significantly below their eventual genetic potential, and then you have those that are kind of approaching their genetic potential. And I think you have to train those athletes a little differently. You know, when you're dealing with a developmental athlete, whether they're a talented person who is undeveloped, you can train speed power at very frequently with those people, you know, and I train those people 3 or 4 days of speed power in a week very easily. They're talented, but they're not good yet, and because of the fact that they exhibit speed power at fairly low levels, the internal damages that they produce as a result of this work are fairly minimal, and therefore they can do the work more often and they can recover more easily. However, when you get an athlete who is emerging at an elite level, starting to scrape that genetic ceiling, so to speak, then the horsepower has been developed, the speed power qualities have been brought to the forefront, and the internal damage that those high horsepower athletes produce is much greater. And because of that, they require more rest and recovery between those bouts of work. So in short, a lot of people tend to think that, you know, a higher level athlete can train speed power more frequently. My experience is that it's been just the opposite. You know, typically 2 days a week with a really talented athlete, speed power wise, is actually what I typically do with the elite types of athletes. I understand that that might sound a little surprising, but they actually need the recovery. Now, those days are obviously much more taxing and much more difficult and really something special to watch. But I think what we have to understand is that the talent that makes these athletes good also produces more internal forces and therefore more internal damage. And as a result, they need that extra time for recovery. You know, I always liken it to like driving your car. You know, if you're driving down the street 20 miles an hour in your car and you check a text and then you drive into a telephone post, well, you know, your insurance goes up, but it's not a catastrophe. But if you do that at 100 miles an hour, you know, it's a disaster. Well, your better athletes operate at 100 miles an hour, so the little things they do and such produce more damage and produce more of these, more need for restoration. So generally speaking, the closer an athlete gets to their genetic potential, the more intense the speed power sessions need to be, but the more they need to be spaced out. And I pay a lot of attention to athletes in my testing program, and as long as the tests are progressing upward fairly regularly, then I pretty much just train, but then I become a lot more discreet in what I do, and I move to more of a as-needed or a more purposeful type of training basis once I start to see the testing results level off.
Okay. So that's a great answer, and I love that analogy with the car. It's such a great kind of narrative and visual to understand what happens with those athletic groups and populations. And with what you were just saying, could you so basically when athletes progress throughout the year, but then their tests start to level off, how could you explain again how you approach that? So once an athlete starts to stagnate on those jump tests,
when I start to see that their You know, when you bring an athlete into your program initially, they go up in everything, you know, and you pat yourself on the back for a great coaching job. But the reason everything goes up is because they're young and undeveloped. But there eventually comes a time when you start to see things level off and you don't see commensurate rises in all the tests simultaneously. And you start to see some tests fluctuate and so forth. When I see the test results tend to level off, that's when I go to a more high intensity but less frequent approach to the speed power training bouts.
Okay. Oh, perfect. Yeah, that's a great explanation there. Thank you. So the next piece I wanted to get into was your thoughts on complex training and the potentiation effects of strength and barbell work. So what do you think are some basic principles on integrating the combination of barbell and plyometric or speed work? As well as using like a barbell, a barbell workout as on its own to potentiate work that athletes do in their sport or on the track.
Well, it's unquestionable that power training improves rate coding capabilities and synchronization. Basically, power training improves the neuromuscular integration. Power training improves the nervous system's ability to activate muscle tissue. Basically, it makes the speed, it makes the muscle and nervous system play well together. They operate well together, and they're more efficient as a result of power training. So my whole basic training scheme is based upon the fact that power training produces improvements in neuromuscular integration. You know, all of my long-term periodizations are set up so that power training phases set the table for advanced speed development or advanced strength development. When I look at complexes, I see the same type of approach. The only difference is it's a more of a short-term approach as opposed to a more long-term type of approach. So a lot of people look at my long-term training models and the periodizations, and it kind of piques their interest because they see some things that are a little different there. But basically, I look at not only a complex within the weight room, but a complex as far as an entire session being a complex. And I also look at an entire year as being a long-term type of complex. So the whole premise is quite valid, and it's something that I use very frequently. Now, as far as short-term complexes within the weight room, I frankly don't do a whole ton of things that are very complicated, meaning I'm pretty simplistic in my approach to that. I do understand the value of potentiation in the weight room, but also keep in mind that I don't typically work the weight room in a vacuum or separate or alone. I typically see the weight room as part of an entire training session, and quite often the weight room is part of a complex, a bigger complex, a day-long complex. So I like to use, people often ask me why I do the sprint work and the plyometric stuff before the weight room. Does it produce fatigue? Well, yeah, it produces fatigue, but it also produces the potentiation. So that's a form of a complex as well. Now, within the weight room, the actual complexes that I like to use, they're more for the sake of developing a more complicated training stimulus. You know, you get to the point where you've squatted, you've cleaned, you've snatched, and you've done those things, and you've done your sets and your reps, and things have been compartmentalized. I think a lot of the value of the complex is not just in the potentiation, because you get the potentiation anyway from all the other things that you're doing if you're training well. I think a lot of the value of the complex actually comes simply because it makes the training stimulus a lot more complicated than it would be otherwise.
Okay, so philosophy a little bit more on more so than in the single session of the weight room, trying to go back and forth using the speed and the plyometrics to make the weightlifting session a little bit better.
Exactly. Well, see, what I'm saying is that I don't put a ton of effort into potentiating weight room work with other forms of weight training or with plyometric training because I'm doing that already. You know, in other words, people say, well, you don't use complexes. No, every training session I do is a complex because I specifically devise the stuff that I'm doing outside of the weight training session in order to stimulate the athletes and to prepare them for the weight training session. And at the same way, at certain times of the year, I like to flip things around and then use either the plyometrics or the weight training to potentiate speed development at certain times of the year as well. So I use that concept of potentiation all the time, long term and short term, but you probably won't see it as far as the more traditional type of complexes if you look at the training that I write. I know I've complicated your question to a great degree, and I know you probably weren't expecting me to go in that direction with it, but that's genuinely how I look at it. I look at everything you do has a potentiation effect, and that all of the long-term and short-term periodization models are based upon that. So I don't think there's a need or a reason to do anything overly magical in the weight room itself, because if the training is well designed, then you've already achieved those potentiation effects, and you've already set the table for what you're trying to do there.
Sure. No, that's a great answer, and no worries at all about going into the detail, because that's something I really enjoy, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners do too, for sure. And I actually had another question for you based off what you just said. Using the idea of using weights and plyos to potentiate speed is really fascinating to me. It brings me to remembering something. I think Lauren Seagrave mentioning something about that, like if you had hit a plateau going in, I think, the regular order of speed, plyos, weights, try it the other way, or something to that tune. But could you give a quick example of how you might use the weights and the plyometrics to potentiate speed?
No, exactly. For a typical default day is sprint, jump, lift, but on certain situations, when I'm trying to do real high-level speed development type of work, what I do is I use Olympic lifts in the 50, 60, 65% type of range in order to potentiate the speed development type of work, Or I do on certain days when I have speed development planned, I extend my warm-up, and then I finish up the warm-up with the plyometric work in advance of the speed development stuff, and I flip the order there for the potentiation. So in short, what I try to do is whatever is the most critical training element of the day, I try to use other elements in order to set up potentiation for that. Now, of course, that's not what I do in general prep, but when I get to specific prep and I'm trying to get to really high levels of execution in certain training elements, that's typically how I try to approach it. One of the things that's very interesting when we discuss this is I get kind of hammered a little bit every now and then because I do speed development with some creatures that you wouldn't normally think I would. For example, if I'm doing dealing with volleyball players, I'll do speed development with them, and it'll raise a few eyebrows because, volleyball players don't really run in their sport, so coaches don't think it's specific. So in short, When I do speed development training with a volleyball player, it's not necessarily to make them faster. It's because the speed development is one of the best potentiation exercises that you can do. So therefore, the speed development takes this potentiation effect or this neuromuscular integration effect and advances it to even higher levels. And what you see as a result of that is improved strength gains and improved power gains and sometimes improved elastic strength types of gains. So in short, the volleyball coach had questioned why I did speed development with the volleyball players is totally on board when the vertical jump goes up 2 inches because of the potentiation effect that they saw from the speed development training. We're continuously geared to think of strength training as an agent to improve speed, but we have to remember that speed training, because of that potentiation effect, is also a huge tool for developing strength as well. We don't think of it the other way.
Yeah, that's an amazing point. Something I've been learning over the last several years, and it's awesome to hear your example, especially with team sports too, because a lot of people listening to this podcast are not just track coaches, but team sports and strength and conditioning coaches. And I actually like to dig even a little bit deeper into how you mentioned the speed session before a volleyball. Would that be something similar to like a standard acceleration development on the track, like running like repeat 20s on a little bit shorter rest to raise a little bit of lactate, as you mentioned, or what would that look like?
Well, I do that with everybody, but that would be taking them out to zones that are even a little bit longer than that and doing genuine absolute speed, top-end speed development in a way very similar to the way a track athlete might do it. And another thing about speed development is that not only does it drive that potentiation effect that we mentioned, but the tension levels that are applied to the tissues are extremely high. They're higher than anything you do in the weight room. If you don't believe me, think about it. You know athletes that have lifted every day of their lives, and then suddenly you take them outside and sprint them, and they're sore the next day. And the reason is these tension levels are higher in speed training than anything you do. So this is another agent that just takes the whole strength aspect even further. So in short, this is why speed and strength, which one causes the other? It's more of a chicken and egg relationship than we typically think it is.
Yeah, I agree. I've spent a lot of time thinking about that chicken and the egg relationship between strength and speed myself. But the great points, especially the max velocity and the muscle tension levels and how that relates to everything. And the next question I had for you is your thoughts on rest, recovery, and deloading. So basically, how often do you think that athletes should deload generally? How long should cycles be? Let's say maybe just for a starting point, say in like an NCAA level athlete, and when they get to the competitive season, should they be deloading more or doing maybe a rollover type setting? What are your thoughts on deloading throughout the course of a season?
Well, I'm pretty standard in that, you know, meaning that, you know, I have one off day a week for sure, maybe two. I always have one easy week in a mesocycle. I find it really difficult to train to do six-week mesocycles, genuine six-week mesocycles, so all my mesocycles are more in the four-week range. Now, I know that the people who are listening out there, sometimes your training calendar just isn't divisible by four, so you have to have a 5 or 6 week mesocycle in there somewhere. But I've always found that 5 or 6 weeks is really hard to do. I mean, you have to deload at some point. And the people I think that are using 5 or 6 week mesocycles effectively, if you look at what they're doing, you see a little bit of a downtime in the middle of the mesocycle somewhere. You know, there's a little bit of a break point in there at some point. So in short, I typically work on a 3-in-1. Now, as far as deloading is concerned, you know, I just want to talk a little bit about rest in general first. You know, we always think of rest as the thing that enables you to prevent injury. And that's true. You know, I understand the balance between work and rest is the most critical, most fundamental training variable there is. But I think sometimes if we would value rest more if we understood that rest is also what enables you to reach. You know, rest is not just about injury prevention. Rest is also what enables you to reach on the harder days. Rest is what enables you to take some well-planned chances in your training design and such. You know, a lot of coaches take my training and they look at it, and they first thing they look at a training week and they say, how in the heck can you do this much work in a week without hurting somebody? And the answer is, if you flip the page a couple pages and you look at the rest week, well, then they're asking the question, how do you dare do this little work in a week? So in short, what I'm saying is your ability to unload and your willingness to unload is a direct requirement for you to be willing and be able to load. And the more you're willing to unload in the rest times, the more risk you can take and the more intensities you can hit in the training times. And I think a lot of training programs don't quite hit the critical mass point where they could be genuinely effective and hit, you know, new peaks, because the peaks are not high and low enough, meaning that the highs are not high enough and the peaks can't be higher because the lows aren't low enough. So in short, if you were going to look at training as an up and down wave, generally speaking, I like high peaks and low peaks much more than more of a steady state type of approach over the course of time. So that's kind of my view of it. You know, I'm really not afraid to unload. And when I rest, I rest. You know, the old Russian saying, when you train, train, but when you rest, rest. I'm not into everything Russia does, but I think that's a good philosophy to take from them. It's just the idea and the value with the unloading. Now, all good coaches understand that you can produce the effects of week of work. I should say you can produce the effects of rest with work, you know, by planning your circuit training appropriately and so forth. So the way your question is phrased, I don't know if you would call a restoration training day a deloading day or whatever. I kind of think of it as one. You know, I when I look at a circuit training day that's geared toward restoration, I don't look at it as a training day. I look at it more as of a day that is a down day or a restoration or an unloading opportunity. So in short, I think that's the other side of it, is understanding how to genuinely produce the effects of rest with some of the work that you do.
Yeah, awesome. I think that's a great point, keeping the highs high and the lows low, and avoiding the extended middle ground, and the idea of resting up so you can take more risks. I hadn't heard it phrased that way before, but it makes a lot of sense, and I think that's a really, really great way of putting it. So the next thing I'd like to talk with you about is, and I think I've heard you talk a little bit about this before, but how much effort should coaches make in individualizing and kind of tweaking out programs to the needs of their athletes, particularly in a scholarly setting where it's not, you know, not professional? And how big are the differences in athletes to the point where you would need to shift, you know, some athletes, maybe sets and reps or how many jumps they're doing? How much work should be done in individualizing programming?
Well, the training theory textbook answer is obviously that you have to individualize everything, but we all know that's not quite true. You know, there are certain training elements that don't have to be individualized. For example, if you're not training eighth graders with Olympians, you know, the warm-up doesn't need to be individualized. You know, there are training elements like general strength that the body assimilates correctly, depending upon the level of the athlete. For example, if you do general strength with a young athlete, the body takes it as training. If you do it with an older athlete, the body takes it as restoration. So the body assimilates it in the way that it needs to assimilate it. You know, the body is very plastic and very smart in that way. But obviously, certain things have to be individualized, and most of our issues in the individualization typically fall into the speed power realm, you know. So obviously the weight room is not hard to individualize. It's very convenient because different kids deliver different weights, but most of the individualization that we have to do tends to fall into either the speed development program or in the plyometric development program. Now, when it comes to this, you have no options. I mean, you must individualize to every single athlete. And I've never, ever written a workout that would be applicable to two people when we're looking at high-level speed development or high-level multi-jump or elastic strength types of training. You know, whether you have the advantages of technology to kind of sense when overtraining is taking place or when you're over, when you're beyond the critical mass point, or whether you have a good coaching eye or whatever, it has to be individualized, and it comes in lots of ways. You know, you've mentioned some volumetric things, but it's not just volume. The exercises you choose, you know, is a big one. You know, if you're doing a depth jumping session, you know, the height of the box is a critical variable. You know, some people just grab whatever box is close by, but, you know, grabbing a 24 versus a 30-inch, that's a huge difference. You know, that's a critical point. So in short, you have to have a system in place where you can individualize things very accurately. And if you're kind of new at this, you have to be able to set up your system in a way that's very measurable. That's one of the reasons, like when I do rehab people, you know, in rehab situations, that's one of the reasons why I really like to use boxes and box jumps with rehab people. And the reason is because it's a very measurable device, meaning that you can very accurately measure exactly what you're doing there. Whereas if you use other forms of exercises, then things become a lot more subjective. So in short, if you're new to coaching or if you're young in coaching, I just advise your listeners to look for tools that you have that are more measurable than otherwise. You know, in a lot of the good coaching education stuff that's out there and a lot of the stuff I've written, I've tried to put, you know, parameters out there, you know, how many meters, how many contacts, and those types of things, so that young coaches can kind of get in the ballpark, so to speak, as to what's too little, what's too much, and kind of understand where they need to be. But even within those accepted parameters, there are big differences, and you have to understand by valuing power output and valuing technical execution when it's time to change the exercise or when it's time to just cut the workout off.
Awesome. So in a nutshell, you would say basically on the speed level of things, or on the remedial level of things, and maybe a little bit more strength, that could be a little more general. But as you move into the realms of speed and plyometrics and high velocity, it needs to become more individual.
And no question, no more question about it. The body can, like I said, can kind of figure out the general side of things, but the speed power stuff has to be done well. And so many of my speed power workouts, are written with a certain exercise and a volume of TBA, because I just don't know. Sometimes you just don't know. Now I can pretty much write a general prep and even a specific prep if I know an athlete and be pretty much on the money. But once athletes start competing, then it's a whole different ball game. In fact, I don't even know that periodization really exists in the competitive season. Then it's more of a matter of reaction and training management, I think.
Okay. Oh, that's a great point too, with that last sentence. And I'm glad you mentioned that as well. I'd like to shift a little bit into some of the final questions, and maybe I'll bunch these last two together a little bit, but I want to get your opinion on how you feel about athletes sprinting farther than their race or event distance, or maybe even their sport maximal distance. And so what would be the use of like over distance training or sprinting a little bit farther than you need to? I guess not taking out of proportion, like, 100 meter runners running like 600s and stuff, but just going farther than typical in a speed training setting.
First thing to think of, I think I've already used one example in this talk. We discussed volleyball players doing speed development. I guess that would be an example of that. And I think that we mentioned how the potentiation effect is there. So that would be one reason why you might choose to do something like that, because of the increased neuromuscular integration and improved potentiation and how that would affect them in other ways. So that would be one reason why you might choose to do something like that. Now, I think it's important to understand that we are looking for specificity, but specificity doesn't necessarily mean what the eye sees. Specificity to us should be based more on what's going on at the cellular level or what's going on at the tissue level, and that would be an example of that. Now, I take it that your question might be going a little more toward the track and field world, whereas there are all these debates about how to train 400-meter runners and this type of thing, Well, I will say this. As far as over-distance training is concerned, the first question is, what are you trying to accomplish from it? Is it an energy system factor, or is it more of a neuromuscular factor? When I coached elite-level long jumpers, I had all of those athletes do 120-meter, 150-meter sprints in training. And the reason why I had them do these sprints in training was because the speed endurance work, this type of sprinting, produces really high-end coordination benefits, meaning that they're much better at coordinating their limbs at high speed, and that produces greater freedom of movement at the board. So this was an example of why a long jumper who might run 130 feet in the long jump might sprint 120 meters in practice, because of the coordination benefits that are derived from that highly specific forms of speed work. So that would be another reason why that type of work might be applicable in certain situations. The coordination effect. Now, when we look at the energy system side of things, and then speed things, we have to keep in mind, like, for example, in a 400-meter training program, that these energy system benefits are only valuable if they're done in a specific format. So in short, should an athlete, like a long sprinter, do over distance? Yeah, sure. But the over distance has to be of a very high quality, which means that the volumes need to be very, very low. For example, if I'm coaching a 400-meter runner, typically I would, once a week, sprint them 450 meters. And this 450 meters was done to improve their buffering capabilities. It was done to improve rhythm. It was done for confidence and all of these other factors. But for me to try to do five 450s in a practice rather than one, is pretty ridiculous, because then we're going to end up walking 450s. So in short, there's nothing wrong with an over-distance approach, provided the volumes are extremely low, and low enough to ensure that the quality of the work stays in a zone that is specific to the event itself. You know, so for example, the old, that's why a lot, in my opinion, a lot of the old school training models for like 400 meters are really dated, you know, to go out and run 500, 600. Well, if you run 500, 600s, well, all the 600s are going to be at a pace that's so much slower than the actual 400 itself that you really haven't accomplished anything specific there. But if you told me that you were going to run one of them really well and then maybe take 15, 20 minutes of break and finish with a 300 and send the kids home, well, that makes a lot more sense. You know, I think it's very important to understand that this over distance premise has value if you keep the quality very high and the volumes very low. Now, the converse of that, the question that always brings up, well, then where do you get your capacity from? Well, your capacity has to be done with efforts that are shorter than the race distance. There's no question about that, because this is the only way that you can assure the quality of the work stays high. So, for example, if I'm training, and please keep in mind that I'm greatly oversimplifying this, that if I am training a 400-meter runner for endurance, yeah, I'm going to run a 450 or a 500 in practice once a week. That's going to be a real high-quality type of effort for the reasons that we just mentioned. But there's going to be some other day when they're going to run something like 15 by 100 or 12 by 120 or something along those lines. And those efforts are going to be very fast, and that's where you're building your capacity work. Now, a coach might argue, well, those efforts are too short to build capacity, but that's not true, because what you're doing is you're building capacity not through any one effort, but through accumulation. You know, you're developing the ability to build capacity using the principle of intermittent work. Because of the fact that you're using shorter distances, the quality of the work can remain much higher. And now, suddenly, the capacity work you're doing is at a pace and at a velocity, at an intensity that is much more specific to what you're trying to accomplish in the event itself. Now, some coaches will argue, well, coach, but these efforts are too short to really produce any type of stress. Well, no, because you control the rest. You know, you can use shorter intervals, you know, and shorter rest intervals as well. So in short, the principle of intermittent work is what we use to build capacity, because the principle of intermittent work, you know, these short work bouts and these short rests enable us to do high volumes of work while still keeping the quality of the work very high. So in short, to answer your question, going back to put it all in a nutshell, we have to build our capacity with higher intensity efforts that are shorter, but single, very low volumes of over distance at quality paces is valuable if we understand how to use it correctly.
That's awesome. Very well put. I'm going to get to a question here that's very similar, well, sort of similar, and something that's been fascinating to me in learning more about it over the last few years. And that's the idea of using lactate as an anabolic agent. So doing workouts where you specifically are trying to get the lactate level up a little bit. Can you talk about how a little bit of the philosophy of that and how you might use that in a workout to help with the anabolic aspect of things?
Yeah, well, we know that really high levels of glycolytic work, you know, work that you're not accustomed to, that's a neuromuscular irritant. So it really stuns the nervous system and keeps us from, and it makes it difficult to really get good improvements in speed when you're subjecting athletes to really high dosages of glycolytic work on a regular basis. However, mild to moderate levels of lactate are directly linked to increases in growth hormone. So we know that lactate that athletes can handle in mild to moderate doses produces these growth hormone effects and increases serum growth hormone increases, and as a result of that, it's highly restorative in nature. So what I try to do is I am always looking for opportunities to subject my athletes to lactate in mild to moderate doses. This is why when they're doing acceleration development, I typically crowd the rest just a little bit, not enough to destroy the speed qualities of the workout, but enough to allow a touch of lactate to accumulate. You know, the lactate accumulation is not enough to really destroy the power output, but it is there and it is enough to produce an androgenic effect. So that way, in an acceleration development workout, if you kind of hit the recoveries right, you're getting the speed and power development and the restoration all in one nice tight package. So it's kind of like your birthday. It's all there for you. That's why certain light Olympic lift days, I like to kind of crowd the recovery intervals just a little bit so that we accumulate just a touch of lactate over the course of time. That's also why almost all of my circuit training is devised using work rest ratios that give me the lactate ranges that I'm kind of looking for, you know, lactate ranges that kind of fatigue the athletes but don't destroy their power output capabilities. That way I'm pretty sure that we're getting a restoration type of effect from that type of work. So, you know, for years we always thought that lactate was like a big evil thing as far as the speed development world is concerned, but I found just the opposite. You know, when I was a really young coach, you know, I did all these circuits in the fall because that's what the training theory book said to do. And then when I quit doing them in the late fall, then we just didn't look quite as good. And I just started noticing that if I kept some moderate lactate stuff going, that everybody just looked better and everything just went better. And it wasn't until years later where we started to see some of this research coming out that we started to make a little bit of sense out of it, you know.
That's great. For everyone listening, could you give maybe one example, either maybe an acceleration development or Olympic lifting workout, where you give an example of some of the distances and rests you would use to get that mild to moderate lactate accumulation?
Yeah, practically, like I'll bring the kids into work in the weight room and I'm doing like either snatches or cleans, like six sets of five or so at around 60-65% or so. You know, so the bars are moving really fast there. And I know you can accomplish power development at two or three reps, but I choose to go four or five just to get a little bit more, a little bit of touch of lactate. And what I typically do is I put three kids on the platform. If you put three kids on the platform and they take their turns in rotation, then the recoveries end up just absolutely perfect. They'll accumulate a little bit of lactate over the course of the workout, but what they accumulate will not be enough to significantly drop their power output levels, meaning the bars are moving just as fast as they would be otherwise.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I've actually seen groups of throwers doing sets of two versus sets of four or five, and my initial thought was, oh, it'd be silly to do four or five, but then those throwers got really strong doing those fours and fives, even though we talk about the technical breakdown or whatever, but it worked. That you just bring that example up, that was kind of the first time I've heard anyone talk about it outside of my experience. So it's good to get that idea.
Yeah, well, there's places for the ones and the twos, don't get me wrong, you know, when you're lifting heavier and everything. But if I can get a touch of lactate, I'm going to get it. You know, that's what I'm looking at. You know, I understand that might sound a little odd, but try it. You'll like it.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned the ones and the twos as well, because obviously there is going to be that need to get back down there. Last couple of questions about skill acquisition. So when you're approaching building the proper technique, whether it be a jumper and they're on the runway and jumping, or we could even take this into team sport athletes and skill acquisition, running or whatever team sport skills people are doing, how do you approach, and this question could be very extended, but you know, in a maybe more simple answer, how do you approach building the proper technique in athletes, and what's your take on corrective drills versus a whole, you know, whole practice or using cues within a whole practice type setup?
Well, first of all, my personal observations and every drop of motor learning research that's ever come out support whole practice. Now, I do understand that there are some skills that are far too complicated to do in a whole environment on the first day of practice. But everything points to the fact that we should practice skills in their whole form as opposed to breaking them down into drills. So I'm not a drill person. I'm really not. I think drills are a comfort zone for athletes, and they're often a comfort zone for coaches. When I have a coach who calls me and says, what's the drill to fix this problem, I kind of cringe, because drills don't fix anything. You know, drills are environments to teach in. That's all they are. You know, and don't get me wrong, there are some things that you might do that might put an athlete in a better situation in order to correctly execute some skill. And that would be the value of a drill, possibly. I think drills are valuable in that sometimes they allow us to get more repetitions faster than the actual skill itself. But the whole skill is where you have to spend your time. And I do think that most coaches who run into problems with skill acquisition fall into one of two categories. Either they're drill masters, meaning they have all these drills, really don't understand how to make the drills work for them, or they're not good cueers, meaning that they're either not adventuresome enough in their cues or they're not skilled enough in their cue systems in order to get the results that they want. I think that you have to be radical in cueing at certain times. You have to be adventuresome in your cueing. And I think that many coaches are handcuffed by the simple fact that either they are afraid to say the wrong thing. Well, that's never been the fear of mine. If I say the wrong thing, I'll just shut up and won't say it a second time, you know. But it didn't wreck anything permanently. And the other thing is that, you know, coaches, I think sometimes we want to make sure we're on the right track. So, you know, sometimes I think we as coaches think that we'll fix something a little bit and then fix it a little bit more, and then eventually we'll get it where we need it to be. And very seldom does that work. Typically, you have to almost approach it as though it's a radically different skill and just, you know, just completely perform a motor amputation, so to speak, when a skill isn't correct. So in short, I just think that coaches are far too timid and not adventuresome enough in their cueing and in the degrees or the radical nature in which they should be cueing. So in short, I think that's a big part of it. Another thing that I think coaches, we screw up quite often with skill acquisition is that we don't schedule it during the correct times of the year. You know, normally we think of technique and skill acquisition as something that happens after we get in shape. Nothing could be further than the truth. You know, your skill acquisition needs to take place during your general prep. You know, if you get to the middle, I'd say early to mid specific prep, and you don't have the skill, the technical models for whatever skills you need in place and fairly stable, then you're pretty much doomed to failure, because the training intensities in late specific prep are going to be such that you won't effectively be able to teach anything. You know, I always noticed that my athletes' technique got, you know, this is in a track and field scenario, all through September, October, and November, their techniques got better and better and better. Then when we got to late November and December, their techniques got a little bit worse. Never bothered me, but the reason why was because that was our heaviest, most intense training time of the year. If I had waited until that time of the year to put a priority on skill acquisition, then I would have been doomed to failure at that point. So in short, I think that improper scheduling and not valuing the fact that skill acquisition has to occur much earlier in the calendar than we traditionally think is another reason why these training programs fail.
Yeah, that's great stuff. And I think that, yeah, a lot of us kind of think of early on, you know, oh, it's the fall or it's early season, let's just do work, not cue things and coach up technique. And then, yeah, when intensity goes up, it's a little bit more difficult. The last question I had for you is, what are some of the biggest mistakes that you see coaches make in the weight room, both for track and field as well as team sports?
Well, I think most of the mistakes I see in the weight room fall into one of three categories. The first one is underspecificity, meaning that we're just kind of doing weights to do weights, and we just haven't really truly examined what the demands of the event are in a motor sense and what are the demands of the event at the cellular level and at the tissue level. So we're just lifting weights to say we're lifting weights, and we really aren't being specific at all. Another common mistake that I see is overspecificity. You know, the whole purpose of the weight room is to get specific, not in so much in your movement patterns, but in what's going on at the tissue level and at the cellular level and with blood chemistry. So, for example, I see lots of exercises that are designed to mimic specific events. They're very functional in their nature, but because they're very functional in their nature and they resemble the event, they become the catch-alls and they become the coach's favorites. But often the most functional exercises don't involve enough muscle tissue to produce the really big changes in the nervous system and in blood chemistry. So in short, being over-specific in the weight room can often make you more gimmicky, and then you miss out on the really big changes that we can get from those global types of adaptations that we're looking for. And the third type of mistake that I see most commonly in the weight room is lifting in improper zones in season. You know, if you're doing something in season, it has to be either restorative or it has to be specific. So I feel that far too many coaches lift in middle zones. You know, if I'm going to lift in, let's just take Olympic lifts, for example. You know, if I'm going to lift in season, I'm lifting super heavy. And the reason why I'm lifting super heavy is because it's very specific at the tissue level. I might lift super light to produce the lactate levels and the power output levels I need, and that's restorative in nature. But lifting in the middle zones, it's not intense enough to be specific, but it's intense enough to make it very difficult to recover from. So it just ends up being training baggage. You know, many, many years ago, Charlie Francis wrote some stuff about intensive tempo and how he doesn't like intensive tempo. As he says, it's not fast enough to be sprinting, but it's too fast to easily recover from, so therefore I would prefer not to do it. I think that same philosophy of training needs to be applied in the weight room, meaning that in season you're either light and restorative or you're really heavy and very specific. And those middle zones, again, they don't really serve a purpose other than training baggage. You know, when I teach classes, I always give the example. I don't drink beer at all. I drink water because it's very good for me, and maybe I'll drink liquor because it does the job real quick. But the beer is kind of in that middle zone, you know, where it kind of over, you know, it's hard to recover from, but it nearly doesn't produce the effects that you're looking for with alcohol. I know that's a little bit of a facetious example, but if you can kind of take that and understand how that might apply to the training theory world, then I think you can kind of understand my point.
That's great. That's great. I was thinking about Charlie Francis as well as you said that, and I love your illustration and narrative there. And that's awesome stuff for in-season thoughts, and thank you for sharing that. And thank you for being on the show too as well. That's all the questions I have for you, Boo, but I really appreciate the answers, and I know the listeners are going to learn a lot. I know I did. And thank you for taking the time here with us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. I've really enjoyed it. I always appreciate it when I get a chance to talk with smart people, and this has been a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in today. Again, please visit our sponsor, simplyfaster.com, high-end sports training technology suppliers. I got so much out of this episode. I hope that you were able to take many things away as well. Boo is such a great coach and educator, and it's great to have him on. We'll see you guys next week.